Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm Corey Cook, sitting in for Joseph Pache and Lauren Meltzer. Our topic this hour is immigration reform. The so-called Gang of Eight is working towards a bipartisan framework for comprehensive immigration reform. If they're successful, this could be the most significant change to the nation's broken immigration system in more than a generation. Despite general optimism that a compromise can be broached, big questions remain. How to create a path to citizenship for the estimated 11 million undocumented immigrants currently living in the United States, how to address what some advocates call a chronic shortage of highly skilled workers, and how to define enforcement and deportation practices that are fair, just, and effective. This hour, we'll focus on federal immigration reform and explore how the Bay Area's experience can inform and advance a national debate. What are the region's most urgent concerns when it comes to immigration? How serious is the skilled worker shortage in Silicon Valley? And what can we learn from federal enforcement of ESCOM and the efforts of local cities to serve as sanctuaries? Joining me in studio to discuss these issues and more are Professor Bill Ong-Hing, Professor of Law at the University of San Francisco School of Law. Professor Hing chairs the City of San Francisco's Immigrant Rights Commission and is the founder, General Counsel and Board Member of the Immigrant Legal Resource Center in San Francisco. Welcome, Professor Hing.
Thank you.
Also with us is Angela Chan, Senior Staff Attorney managing the Criminal Justice Reform Program at the Asian Law Caucus, a nonprofit organization dedicated to advancing the rights of the Asian Pacific Islander community. She also serves on the San Francisco Police Commission, a civilian oversight body that sets policy for the department. Welcome, Angela.
Thank you for having me here.
And we have Emily Lam, Senior Director of Healthcare and Federal Issues for the Silicon Valley Leadership Group, a nonprofit membership organization dedicated to ensuring the economic health of Silicon Valley. Welcome, Emily.
Thank you.
And thank you to all three of you for being with us. We invite you, our listeners, to join our conversation by dialing 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. Or you can email us now at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com or post a comment on klw.org or on our Facebook page. I thought we'd start by giving the listeners a bit of background on the federal debate over comprehensive immigration reform. So, Professor Hing, if you could start, what's on the table? What are we talking about?
Well, probably the biggest driver is the fact that there's an estimated 10 to 12 million undocumented immigrants in the United States. But beyond that, there are issues related to whether or not more border security is necessary. There's issues related to employment verification in terms of what employers are would be obligated to do when it comes to hiring. And then, of course, there's issues with respect to family backlogs in the family immigration system, perhaps some changes to asylum policy and criminal immigration enforcement.
So it's a fairly comprehensive set of issues.
All those things are on the table.
And so there is some difference between what the so-called Gang of Eight is talking about, what the president's pushed forward, at least leaked, I guess, to the press. What do you see as the major differences?
Well, one major difference is the fact that the president is actually pushing for recognition of same-sex binational marriages. Under current immigration law, a same-sex marriage is not recognized. And as we know, the president is opposed to DOMA, and he chimed in recently on the Prop 8 case. And consistently with that, in the president's bill, he's actually pushing for recognition of marriages in same-sex binational situations. But everything else is actually fairly similar with possible exception. Again, the president is a little bit more progressive on how to deal with lawful immigrants who have committed crimes.
But both are talking about beefed up border security. Both are talking about a path to legalization for undocumented immigrants. Both are talking about some version of this employer verification and mandates.
And both put Dreamers ahead of the line for legalization. Both require some sense of border security before the rest of the undocumented population can actually get lawful permanent residence.
How would that work?
Well, the president has a checklist of factors to consider in terms of when the border is secure. And it's such things as X number of Border Patrol officers, a certain amount of attention that's paid to the border, a reduction in the number of undocumented immigrants coming across, whereas the Senate is much more nebulous. They want evidence that the border has been secured, and the determination of that would be put in the hands of southern border state officials who would create comprise membership in a commission that would give the go-ahead that, okay, the border is now secure. Only until those conditions are met, depending on which bill, would individuals be able to actually get a green card. In the meantime, they would be in some temporary status.
Oh, interesting. I want to see if we can start by talking a little bit about the politics around this, because you know this isn't the first go-around for comprehensive immigration reform. It was something that's been proposed, I think, by the last four administrations. It hasn't gotten very far. What's the push this time? Why is this on the agenda again? Why does there seem to be a lot of enthusiasm this might actually pass? Emily, do you want to start?
Sure. On the part of businesses, the urgency for being able to recruit and retain the best and the brightest people from around the world is more acute. In the past, it's been a given that if you were coming here to America to study, you would do everything you can to stay here. But with the rise of, you know, global competition, it's actually very competitive now to get some of these highly skilled workers. And what used to be a given 10 or 15 years ago, that they would want to stay and build a life here, is no longer true. There is opportunity and infrastructure back home where they often came from. And also, not only is it a lot easier for them to go back home, it may be easier for them to find a job in Canada or Brazil, where, you know, they welcome immigrants and actually are, you know, folks are trying to recruit them. So, we've spent the last 10 years asking for these reforms, and we feel as though the more time that passes, the more we lose in terms of our ability to compete to recruit and retain these smart folks.
And it seems like there's some agreement between business and labor this time around. Is that the case?
Yes, I definitely believe so. I think that it's very tempting for each of the different stakeholders to say they would like, you know, their piece of it taken care of. And I think in the past, people have said, you know, I want to stay away from a comprehensive bill because it makes it less likely that we will get our reforms passed. I think the calculation has changed since the election. There's been a mandate from the voters, as well as from the different stakeholders, that we need to band together now to actually make comprehensive reform go, especially since it's been very clear that the president and the Democratic-controlled Senate will not pass a bill unless it is comprehensive.
I'm interested in this election impact, because you mentioned that this mandate from the election. During the Republican primary, Republican candidates ran as far away from immigration as they possibly could or went to the extremes. Why is there now a push for this? Why is there an election mandate?
Yeah, that analysis, I think, has been it's been so blatant and so obvious now, and I think that's why we're in a different place than we've been in the last several cycles where we've worked on comprehensive immigration reform. I mean, it's kind of black or white, very obvious. There's a large number of Latino members of the community and also Asian members of the community who are voting strongly Democrat, in part because they feel like the Republican Party is not welcoming them and including them in the party and in the future of the party. When you have rhetoric from the Republicans such as you should self-deport, that's our stance on immigration.
The Republican nominee, that was obviously that was his line during the Republican primary, so that's a little bit problematic.
It is. It's we don't want you in our party. We don't care about your vote. We have no interest in catering to your interest. You're not in a part of our future. And obviously that rhetoric did not get them very far with the presidential elections and other elections. I think another bad part of the calculation for the Republicans is the Arizona SB 1070 anti-immigrant type laws that they then spread through other states trying to pass that. And that just those are very obvious, very blatant anti-immigrant laws that say that, again, we don't want you. We don't want you as a part of our community and what we do. And I think with the punishment that they received, so to speak, from the immigrant community in November elections, there's now a brand new awakening and a much more open door, open arms to doing something different. I think there's still some caution of we're not sure. You know, it's a brand new direction for the Republican Party, so they still are cautious, and that's why you do see a Senate framework and a House framework that are more cautious and limited than the White House's bill. But it is good that we are in a new place where there is a gang of eight that's bipartisan.
And it seems like it's a little bit of a tough coalition, though. I mean, today, former Florida Governor Jeb Bush came out and said he now opposes a pathway to legal citizenship, which is a, you know, he could be considered a moderate immigration issue. So it seems like this might be a fragile coalition.
Yeah, I think that what's going on is that there's a the Republican Party, and you could say this about the Democratic Party as well. You know, it has a split personality, and when it comes to immigration, I think that while what we all learned after November was the Republicans, it was a wake-up call for the Republicans when it comes to immigration. I don't think that that necessarily translates to a very generous path to citizenship. If a guest worker plan, for example, were the main part of the bill, that might fly, because the truth is many undocumented workers in the United States might be willing to simply accept that. And I think that many in the Republican Party are banking on getting something done, not necessarily comprehensive in terms of a major path to citizenship. And if they can get something done, then they can claim that they helped to do that and get on with other issues that the Republican Party is in trouble with Latinos and Asian Americans and other people of color as well. So I'm not that enthusiastic. I'm not that hopeful that the Republicans, especially in the House, are going to come along very far when it comes to what is going to be contained in the House bill, which hasn't been dropped yet.
One of the pieces in 2007, when then-President Bush proposed this, Pew just came out with a study last month. It's pretty remarkable, showing the role of talk radio and Fox News and others in really ramping up the talk about immigration in 2007. What do you see as part of the national discourse now? How do you hear this being talked about, whether it's on the radio or in television? Is it different than 2007? What's your sense?
So I think, for instance, Senator Rubio going on talk show, on conservative talk shows about the path to citizenship is really important. That's something that's very different. So both Senator Rubio and Representative Labrador from Idaho are going to play a really important role to bridging the Republican Party with the Latino community. And although Senator Rubio may be standing alone, the fact that he is actually on these talk shows talking about a path to citizenship, certainly different and a step forward.
Yeah, and as we saw this weekend here in California with the Republican mid-year meeting, the Republicans in California understand that they're way behind on an issue like this. But it's interesting that Emily mentioned Labrador, because Labrador, who's from Idaho, is Latino, used to be an immigration lawyer, but he's taken this very staunch position against a pathway to citizenship as well. And how much influence he has in the House Republican Party is going to militate what is contained in the bill. And frankly, many of us are quite worried. They were supposed to leak, not they were supposed to reveal many of the elements of the House bill the same day as the President's State of the Union address, and it's been, 2 weeks now, and nothing has come out yet.
Well, it'll be interesting in the House, because Speaker Boehner is taking votes now of things, the Violence Against Women Act, for example, that the majority of the caucus did oppose. And historically, this is called the Hastert rule, it's just then-Speaker Dennis Hastert, that you would oppose, you wouldn't bring bills to a vote that Republicans opposed in the caucus. So it seems like there might be room there, or no?
Well, that's a really good point, because now Boehner's done it three times, right? Mm-hmm. Did it with the fiscal cliff, and then I'm forgetting what the very first one at the beginning of the year here,
right.
And then the VAWA bill, and it was the Hurricane Sandy bill.
Oh, right,
bill.
Hurricane Sandy, right.
And so we're hopeful that he will look at the bigger picture for the Republican Party, irrespective of what a small group of Republicans in the House are saying, and that he goes for comprehensive immigration reform. But it's all theory at this point.
And so what do you think?
I think another change that's come about since the last time we've debated CIR is Dreamers. Dreamers have come out in strong force the last few years. They've been on the cover of Time magazine. Mm-hmm. You have people like Jose Antonio Vargas, a former reporter who came out as undocumented, and people are just getting out there and sharing their stories. I think the slogan is undocumented and unafraid. And when you are confronted with someone's humanity, with someone being a young person that grew up in this country and want to be a part of this country, it's harder to dehumanize a group. And there is now a movement amongst activists and amongst Dreamers to say, don't call us illegal. No human being is illegal. Instead, we're undocumented. It's a piece of paper that separates me and you, and it's something that we can fix. It's a part of a broken system. So I think that moral force, that argument, and that humanity has really helped, I think, with comprehensive immigration reform this time around. So there is, it's a little bit more grounded, hopefully, knock on wood.
And do you see that changing the national discourse? Does that change our language around this?
I think very much so, because the Dreamers now, I think, are leading this in that they're saying, not only do we... are we Americans and that we embrace this country and we want to be a part of the future here, but we want our parents and our families to not be separated. And so we don't want just the DREAM Act. We actually want comprehensive immigration reform. So you have groups like United We Dream, who held a very massive conference of Dreamers this just last month or so in the Midwest, where they came up with principles that are very broad, that aren't just about their particular interests, but also just broadly LGBT interests, the interests of keeping their families together, and also on pushing back against inhumane enforcement measures.
And that's pretty courageous political action to have a conference and do that sort of work.
That's right. I think it's I think it speaks volumes that you have the children of immigrants who sacrificed themselves to bring their children here, who are now leading the movement and talking not just about themselves but about their communities and their families. I think it's quite moving when you look at the testimony, for example, of Jose Antonio Vargas in front of the Senate, in front of the House, and just how personal that testimony is, how riveting that is to you. Even if you do or do not know much about immigration, just that connection that it makes to people thinking about their families and why their families might have come to this country decades ago, hundreds of years ago. I think it's quite uplifting and hopeful.
Yeah. Emily.
Something that I think that also changes the political calculus is where the voters are. So oftentimes when we go to Washington asking for immigration reform, you can see that politicians are afraid of being punished by their constituents. And you saw the national polls after the November elections showing that 65% of voters, not just of the people in your district, of voters are saying that they're in favor of a path to citizenship, which traditionally has been considered the most difficult part of the bill. But not just voters, but if you look across Democrats, Republicans, you know, different ethnicities and races, the majority of even Republicans support a path to citizenship, 46% over 42%. And so that definitely puts, you know, our elected officials to make their calculation that, okay, I could potentially support something like this without being punished.
So I want to talk about some of the local effects of the national legislation. So, you know, as I said, this isn't the first go-around for immigration reform. What are your hopes for what might be achieved? Emily, if we could start with you about some of the, whether it's the visas or the startup visas or some of the things you're hoping will be achieved through this.
Sure, absolutely. So for the larger companies, we're hoping for an increase in the number of H-1Bs and green cards that are available for skilled workers. And for the smaller companies, the startups, the creation of an entrepreneur visa would be extremely important, both not only the numbers, but also the facility and the speed in which they can access these is going to be really important.
Can you explain a little bit more about the entrepreneur visas? How would that work? What's the intent?
Currently, there are not very many good pathways for you to start a company and get a visa. So right now, most of the time when you want to start a visa, you're either in school and you come up with a great idea and you're kind of riding off of that student visa, or, you know, there's something called an O-1, which is for people with extraordinary abilities that you have to prove that you have a very unique quality. And those are really hard for people to fit into. And so we would like to see the creation of a startup visa as outlined, for instance, in Senator Moran's Startup Act, a bipartisan bill that would create a separate category that basically allows an entrepreneur to quickly get a visa if they both have raised capital, are hiring some American workers, and have some kind of business plan. So that's something that the entrepreneur community, the startup community, the venture capital, a lot of the people both in San Francisco and in Silicon Valley are very much in favor of.
So specifically to Silicon Valley, how will this help the region in your view?
So if you think about the success of Silicon Valley, a lot of it starts, for instance, from entrepreneurs who start the innovation cycle. And without them in, you know, inventing things and coming up with things, we don't have the success that Silicon Valley has seen. So it's both important for startups and important for large companies that now innovate by buying smaller companies to continue to have that cycle go forward. And, you know, all of the previous success that Silicon Valley has seen has come from people innovating. And so human capital is really important to us. And again, as I mentioned previously, you know, we are starting to lose the talent across the globe to have these people who are bright and have these ideas stay here.
Professor Hang, what are you looking for in the legislation? What's important?
Probably beyond the legalization program, clearing the backlogs of the family immigration categories is a major concern to Latino and Asian immigrants. After the immigration system changed in 1965, in one way helping Asians, but in another way hurting Latino immigrants, there began to develop a backlog in family immigration categories over the last several decades, so that today some people may have to wait, depending on the country, as much as 20, 30 years before their number is reached in the backlog. And so both bills that have been revealed so far, the Senate bill and the President's bill, would provide extra numbers to help clear the backlogs and so that the family immigration categories would not be so seriously backlogged. And that's important because people have been waiting to be reunified. Oftentimes when that can't be done, that actually in not so subtle way increases undocumented immigration. And those who don't do it unlawfully, they wait, they are demoralized, their family is broken, and in many respects it's a reflection of the past history of Asian exclusion laws and border enforcement and not recognizing the cyclical nature of the Mexican migration pattern. And so we're looking for clearing the backlogs as a major need.
And you mentioned the same-sex partner provision. Senator McCain was quoted, I guess, recently as saying that it wasn't a priority or wasn't significant. What do you think?
You know, I think that worse than that, part of the coalition that is pushing for immigration reform includes evangelicals and the Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. And those supporters of comprehensive immigration reform have said that they won't support comprehensive immigration reform if UAFA, the United American Families Act, is included in the bill. And so that's problematic. I think that there's going to have to be some serious soul searching on everybody's part as to whether or not we're finally going to recognize the rights of same-sex marriage partners.
Might that be handled through the courts? I mean, might that be part of the outcome of the Supreme Court's hearing on same-sex marriage?
Unfortunately not, because the way the Immigration and Nationality Act has been interpreted by the courts, the language has been held to not include Congress's intent to include same-sex partners. So there needs to be statutory change. Hmm.
Okay. And Angela Chan, what are your hopes for legislation?
Yes, at the Asian Law Caucus, we provide direct legal services to immigrants, and a problem that we see is judicial discretion having been taken away because of some draconian 1996 immigration laws. And so we have a whole set of principles, a whole set of asks for comprehensive immigration reform, but one of the pieces of that is to repeal mandatory detention laws and also reinstate judicial discretion and due process so that people are not unnecessarily detained in our growing immigration prisons and they do get their day in court in front of an immigration judge. Great. And, of course, the visa backlog piece that Professor Hing talked about is primary in our list because we know how long it takes for immigrants to come here illegally.
This is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. Tonight we're discussing immigration reform with our guest Bill Hing, professor at the University of San Francisco School of Law, Angela Chan, senior staff attorney at the Asian Law Caucus, and Emily Lam, senior director of healthcare and federal issues for the Silicon Valley Leadership Group. We invite you to call in with your questions or comments. The number to call to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or you can email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com or post a comment on KALW.org or on our Facebook page. What are you hoping gets left out of the legislation? Maybe more significantly than what gets in. I mean, you know, things like the guest workers program that has been talked about, or the E-Verify, some of the border security. Are there things that you're hoping that might fall out of the conversation?
Well, E-Verify is a good example because, and for the listeners, that would require that employers use this e-verification system that's been tried in Arizona. In fact, it's Arizona law now.
And President Obama talks about this quite a bit.
All the time. And there's two problems with it. One is it's been demonstrated to be faulty. There's an error rate of 25 to 30% that's been established. And secondly, e-verify is based on the concept of employer sanctions, that an employer cannot knowingly hire an undocumented immigrant, that's been in the law since 1986. And time again, it's been demonstrated that the theory of employer sanctions, which is that you would clean up the undocumented immigrants, free up jobs for available U.S. workers, that's never been established, that every employer who's been the subject of big raids or loss of employees has never been able to find available workers. Let's face it, there are certain industries in the United States and certain niches where really there aren't available U.S. workers. And employers, the whole premise of E-Verify is problematic. And I think it's problematic for business as well, because they get caught with a short workforce. The guest worker problem, which is being thrown out there to entice business, is and you alluded to this earlier when you talked about the tentative agreement that the Chamber of Commerce and AFL-CIO have reached, and it was refreshing to see in the plan that they came up with that there's a hint that it won't be a pure guest worker program, that it may start that way, but after a period of time, the workers would be able to work their way into lawful permanent residence. Because the fear of a pure guest worker program is that there's room for exploitation. And even there are two current guest worker programs, the H-2A program and the H-2B program, depending on whether one's agriculture or one's not agriculture. And there are lawsuits every day that are being filed with employment rights organizations and federal and state governmental entities that show that guest workers are exploited in terms of health and safety rules, wage rules, and other problems with respect to wages.
And we've seen this historically through Bracero program and others throughout American history.
Exactly, and we don't want to see a repeat of that. But guest workers is being thrown out there, and they're also being put at the head of the line in terms of legalization with Dreamers in the Senate version anyway.
Again, if you'd like to join the conversation, the number is 415-841-4134. We have Reza from San Francisco.
Good evening. Thanks for taking the call. So my question is that if the current undocumented workers are legalized, and the reason they're here, the premise of my question is that the reason they're here is because they are exploitable and there's a demand for exploitable workforce to work for low wages and not be too vocal about their rights as labor. Once they are legalized and they start to assert their rights, will there not be a sudden increase in demand for new undocumented workers, sort of a vacuum, so to speak, which will then be filled by a new rush of undocumented workers across the border?
Well,
personally, I'm very much in favor of it, of legalizing, but in terms of labor dynamics, I'm curious.
Great. Thank you for your call.
I'll try to give a quick answer to your complicated question. First of all, that assumes that most employers are exploiting undocumented workers. And while there is a certain degree of exploitation that goes on, I don't believe that that's true across the board. The answer to that question really is to allow workers, documented and undocumented workers, to be protected by labor laws. And that's what the unions want. That's what the workers want. If they can fight for their own labor rights, their rights to minimum wage, health care, et cetera, then those jobs, ironically, might be more attractive to available U.S. workers. And so it's in everyone's interest, actually, if those workers are able to assert their labor and employment rights.
Oh, we have a web comment. It says, I came to this country to enhance my knowledge in engineering, and after getting my master's in electrical engineering, I'm at the forefront of technology and in the midst of innovation in the Bay Area. I got my green card through the high-skilled employment category after 5 years, and now I can't get married to my fiancé who's in India because even if I do, I have to wait 3 to 4 years to bring her to the U.S. Isn't my spouse an immediate relative, and shouldn't she be let to join me immediately? He says the writer says, I urge Congress to please abolish the F2A category and consider the spouse of green card holders as immediate relatives. Is that a familiar?
That's really interesting. So this person is a green card holder, and if he was a U.S. citizen, then there would not be a wait. Mm-hmm. But but he's absolutely right. If you have a green card and you're petitioning for your spouse, depending on the country, and India is an example of that, there is a several-year wait. And he's absolutely right. That is kind of crazy that spouses of people with lawful permanent residence cannot immigrate immediately.
Is that something that this legislation will address?
Or? Unfortunately not. That's not in there. Yeah.
But I think in general, one of the issues that the high-tech community has is that there is currently a per-country cap of 7%. So whether you're coming from India or China, some of the most populous countries in the world, versus a tiny little country somewhere else, you essentially have to wait longer than others. So some of our immigrants from India or China who are working for our companies have to wait up to 10 years to get their green cards.
Right. And I did misspeak, Corey, that the bills would address this gentleman's problem by adding more numbers to the family categories.
Speed up the backlog.
And what Emily said is true. If they increase that per country, and they're proposing to increase it from 7% to 15% of the total,
right,
that would help them, actually. That's true.
So part of the way that we want to clear the backlog is to raise the per-country caps and also exempt certain folks. So, for instance, if you had an advanced degree in math or science, then you would be exempt from the cap altogether. Mm-hmm. Or, as Professor mentioned, that it would go from 7 to 15% for spouses and children.
Yeah, I also want to talk a little bit about the enforcement, because, again, there's a lot of talk, particularly from the president, about enforcement. How would that work? Enhance border security? I assume we're talking about ramping up the secure communities, ESCOM. I mean, how is the president and Congress talking about enforcement?
Yeah, it's interesting. Immigrant rights advocates are right now in a heated debate with the White House because they want deportations to be suspended at the moment, because while we're debating comprehensive immigration reform, and while there is a strong possibility, hopefully, that it might pass, it doesn't make sense for the president to continue deporting aspiring citizens, what we call them, as we're waiting for this legislation to make its way through. President Obama has on his resume, he has the highest number of deportations compared to any other president. There are graph charts of this, and it's quite astonishing how many millions of people have been deported under the president. About 400,000 a year under this president, a record number. And the amount of money put towards the border currently is also at a record high. The number of people going through the border is at a low. And so it seems like some of the rhetoric that we're seeing from Republicans isn't based in reality. There isn't tons of people going through the border, and there isn't lax security at the border. In fact, it's actually the opposite. And so those are some of our concerns. And in terms of the Secure Communities Program, which is a fingerprint sharing program between local police and immigration at the point of arrest prior to the individual receiving any sort of hearing in the criminal matter for which they are arrested, it's that program continues to be fully on. It's on in almost every single county in the country. And California now has the highest number of deportations under the Secure Communities Program compared to any other state. We have about 90,000 deportations, and that isn't really being discussed in the CIR debate.
Now, the Attorney General has said that the secure communities enforcement is optional. It's voluntary for local jurisdictions. And yet, so why the high deportation rates?
The Attorney General Kamala Harris in December put out a memo explaining that you do not have to respond to the request from immigration when you are a local sheriff or a police chief, and you don't have to hold someone for immigration. However, she did not speak about the Secure Communities Program, whether or not the fingerprint sharing should still occur. So that information is still being transmitted. Even though police chiefs and sheriffs now have this written legal analysis from our Attorney General, some police chiefs and sheriffs are still embracing this newfound conclusion coming from the Attorney General, and many of them still are responding to the vast majority of immigration holds and holding people in our local jails purely for immigration reasons.
Again, this is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. Tonight, we're discussing immigration reform with our guest Bill Hing, professor at the University of San Francisco School of Law, Angela Chan, senior staff attorney at the Asian Law Caucus, and Emily Lam, senior director of healthcare and federal issues for the Silicon Valley Leadership Group. We invite you to call in with your questions or comments. Again, the number to call in is 415-841-4134. You can email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com or post a comment on KALW.org or on our Facebook page. What about the Trust Act? Either a state Trust Act or a local Trust Act, getting away a little bit from the national legislation, what would the effect of this be?
So the Trust Act is AB 4, Assembly Bill 4. It's a pending bill in California, and it's a bill that's sponsored by Assemblymember Tom Amiano, who is from San Francisco. And this bill, what it does is it limits the responses from local law enforcement to those requests from ICE to hold people in our local jails purely for immigration reasons after they would normally be released in the criminal matter. So let's say they're innocent of the offense, or the district attorney doesn't file charges, or they're actually a victim of crime that was mistakenly arrested. In those cases, we would not hold them for immigration under the Trust Act. That bill made it through both houses in California last year, was vetoed by Governor Brown at the ninth hour on September 30th. But with a open door, with a silver lining in his veto message, he said he agreed with the goals of the bill and had some technical fixes he wanted to make. At this moment, there's still a strong coalition of over 100 organizations that are pushing hard on this bill because for the same reason, we have comprehensive immigration reform in the wing. It doesn't make sense to continue to detain and deport people as we're waiting for this legislation to be pushed through.
And so has the governor given signs that he's going to would sign Assemblymember Amiano's legislation?
He said in his veto message that he would work with the legislature, quote-unquote, forthwith to address his concerns so that he can put out a bill that he can agree with. But we are still waiting for some more concrete amendments coming from the governor. And I should point out that in all the different versions of comprehensive immigration reform coming from the Senate or from the White House, the path to legalization is a very long one. Mm-hmm. Usually 8 years, 10 years, 15 years, we're talking long, long periods of time. During that period of time, it doesn't make sense that we have our local police acting as immigration agents, where minor traffic violations and minor other types of offenses and infractions will lead to someone being held for immigration, deported while they're waiting on this long path to legalization. And so really, in order to have CIR be fair and to be inclusive, you need something like the Trust Act in California and also in every state in the country.
There's also legislation in California for a domestic workers' bill of rights. Professor Hang, have you...
Yeah, I unfortunately ran into the same problem as the Trust Act. It passed the state legislature, and the governor vetoed the bill. And his message on the veto of the Domestic Workers Bill of Rights wasn't as positive even as the Trust Act, and which is puzzling because this is an issue that affects mostly immigrant women, and it's women who are nannies, caregivers of elderly, et cetera, They help to make our society very productive. They're providing all those kinds of services so that couples often or single parents are able to go to work and be productive. And unfortunately, they don't have guarantees of minimum wage. They don't have guarantees of any health care benefits. And the California Domestic Workers Bill of Rights is simply asking for the same treatment as other workers, nothing more, nothing less. And it's been reintroduced. The bill has been reintroduced. I think it's AB 341, although I'm not positive about that. And the hope is that this time around, not only will it pass, but that the governor will sign it.
And this is a governor with a record. I mean, historically, the first time around, he was known as being very favorable towards farm workers and immigrants' rights and workers' rights. I mean, what's your sense of what happened?
Well, he became mayor of Oakland. As the attorney, when he was the attorney general, actually, he took some pretty harsh positions. And one of the only things that he was willing to do when he was the attorney general was actually expand some protections for trafficking victims. But otherwise, as the attorney general, he became very law enforcement minded, and he equated that with being anti-immigrant. And it's a shame because he's equating being soft on immigration with being soft on crime, and it's manifested in some rather puzzling positions that the first iteration of Jerry Brown would have actually gone a different way.
And the Democrats now have 2/3 vote in the Assembly and Senate. Is there a possibility they would actually override a gubernatorial veto on this?
Yeah, I think that in both the situations of the Trust Act and the Domestic Workers Bill of Rights, that's possible. I think it may even be possible for driver's licenses for undocumented drivers, which DMV has come out in favor of issuing some such licenses for public safety reasons. And so... Yeah, I think that depends on how strong the Democrats feel they're willing to stand up to the governor.
Again, to call in for your questions or comments, the number is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. If we could stay on this topic about the driver's licenses, because in California this has obviously been a hotly contested issue. To some extent, this is early Schwarzenegger administration. This was what he said he would do on his first day in office. And I believe one of the couple of things he did do on his first day in office was to work to repeal the legislation on giving driver's license to undocumented workers. What chance is that stand in California?
Well, the driver's license bill has been introduced, I believe, at the Assemblymember Alejo's office, and it's right now the starter version of the bill looks great and is actually very expansive and inclusive, and we'll just see what happens with the bill as it moves along the process. I think that one of the few immigrant rights bills Governor Brown did sign last year was a driver's license bill, but it was a bill that arguably wasn't needed. It gave driver's license to people who qualified for deferred action, Dreamers, but arguably they already would have gotten driver's license because they are able to get a certain identification that would have allowed them to get a driver's license. So, you know, the governor has been quite moderate. I think his philosophy lately has been paddle to the left, paddle to the right, stay in the center. But we are hoping on issues like driver's license and domestic workers and also on things like police, immigration, entanglement, that he will do the right thing as governor.
Yeah, and it's interesting that Illinois just enacted a law that extends driving privileges to undocumented immigrants. And it's also quite interesting that a state that might be labeled conservative, Utah, for example, that has an SB 1070 type of package, but also has some pro-immigration issues in their legislation, they've been permitting undocumented drivers to drive with permits for many years now. And their attorney general is very pro-immigrant and helped to make sure that every law enforcement official in California accepts that driving permit as identification. And not having that identification in California causes a lot of other problems. When you're stopped and you don't have a driver's license, not only can your car be impounded, and that can cost you up to $2,000, but it also means that that you're going to get fingerprinted and run into the secure communities problem. Getting a driver's license would solve a lot of problems for people that are just here to feed their families, keeping their nose to the grindstone to work.
As well as with insurance, is that right? It makes it easier to get...
That's right. And that's why the DMV actually came out with its proposal to extend driver's license, just because they felt that when you go through the training program, then you can get insurance, and then you can get a discount on your insurance, and it would incentivize people not only getting insurance, but driving more safely, obviously.
So what's the argument against? I mean, why is... So, I mean, So why is the governor not pushing this legislation? Why was this the centerpiece of the early Schwarzenegger administration? What's the argument?
Well, I don't think they have a good argument other than these people have broken the law somehow. They've come across the border without inspection, and so why should we reward them for breaking the law? It's kind of an extension of why people. Some people are opposed to legalization.
Right, it's the same argument we hear about the pathway to legalization, that it rewards those who have violated the law. Well, is your group having a stance on driver's license for undocumented immigrants?
No, we don't, actually. And I think that you'll see from the next few months that the business community is very much in favor of immigration proposals that contain the fixes for them to be able to recruit high-skilled workers, and that they're not really experts. We don't have the expertise on some of these other aspects of the bill, so in general, we'll stay away from commenting on things mm-hmm. that we don't know or understand. However, I think that it's been very clear HP, Intel, Microsoft, and others have come out in favor of comprehensive immigration reform as a path to getting their needs addressed. So that's going to be one of the interesting coalitions that we're going to see coming up in the next few months as the bill gets dropped. And as you mentioned before, it is a fragile coalition, I think, because these groups are not necessarily used to being on the same side of issues, but I think a very powerful one that will make it possible for the larger bill to go through.
If we could talk a little bit about sanctuary cities. I mean, you know, a lot of the Bay Area cities are sanctuary cities. How does that, if we could explain to listeners, how does that work? Is that an effective sort of solution locally?
So San Francisco has a sanctuary ordinance that was passed in the 1980s that we've just celebrated an anniversary of recently. And the sanctuary status doesn't do what most people commonly think it does. It doesn't mean that if you're undocumented in San Francisco that immigration can never pick you up and you can never be deported. That's actually quite limited in some ways. What it does is that it says that we should not use our government local employees and resources for immigration enforcement. So our hospitals, our schools, our teachers, our police, for example, should not be focused on immigration enforcement. They should be focused on their local duties, education, fixing our roads, public safety, etc. And that we should. So that really is what our sanctuary ordinance does. But it doesn't prevent immigration from coming in and enforcing and doing what that they do. In fact, there's a really big immigration and customs enforcement ICE detention building that's about 3 or 4 blocks from our office in downtown San Francisco in the financial district. And so ICE is very much active and has very much been engaging in deportation in San Francisco. Under the Secure Communities program that I mentioned earlier, we've had over 700 deportations from San Francisco in the last 2 years. Vast majority of the people, about 7 out of the 10 people, 70%, 7 out of 10 people deported in San Francisco are people without criminal convictions or people who are arrested on lesser or minor offenses. And so it's still quite problematic, and our sanctuary status, I think, helps for creating an inclusive philosophy for our residents, but it doesn't necessarily mean, it doesn't translate into people being fully protected.
Yeah, it's interesting that the concept of sanctuary cities, it actually, that label isn't used by many jurisdictions that engage in what we're talking about. In other communities, it's called community policing. Mm-hmm. So, for example, Los Angeles, Mesa, Arizona, places like that. The idea is public safety, actually. The theory behind making sure that the local law enforcement people are not immigration enforcement people is that if the community, if you want to represent the entire community when it comes to public safety, you don't inure their confidence or their trust if you are labeled an immigration enforcer. So the immigrant community won't trust you if they think that you're going to turn them over to ICE or the old INS. And so the idea is that if you're not in business of helping to deport, then the immigrant community will trust you. They'll come to you and report crime. They'll come to you and report crime that they've witnessed or that they've been victimized themselves. And that helps all of us, because if the police gain the trust of one part of the community, that inures to the benefit of the entire community. And so some jurisdictions are actually engaged in sanctuary city type of practices, But they call it community policing because their idea is to gain the trust of the entire community.
Yeah, in her speech in December, Attorney General Kamala Harris said, "I want that rape victim to be absolutely secure. If she waves down an officer in a car, that she'll be protected." And it's precisely the argument that if right. you aren't taking care of those who are victims of crimes, and they're at risk of actually reporting themselves to an ICE agent.
Right, exactly. And some of the biggest, most vocal organizations that are opposed to sanctuary, to secure communities, for example, are women's organizations that represent victims of domestic violence. Because unfortunately, there have been some incidents when victims of domestic violence have actually been deported. Because many times police officers have to get the story straight when there's an allegation of domestic violence, and they end up fingerprinting both parties. And once that's done, as Angela was saying, those fingerprints are shared with ICE. And if the person happens to be undocumented, there have been some stories where those individuals who were victims actually got removed.
And a high number of people who are deported have no other convictions, committed no crimes.
Yeah, I think the percentage is over 70% of those removed under secure communities were either nonviolent offenders or had no offense at all.
And is there evidence, I assume, of also unequal enforcement of that legislation, right? I mean, I assume that there's also racial profiling and other things that the communities experience.
Yeah, UC Berkeley's Warren Institute actually reviewed the records coming directly from Immigration and Customs Enforcement. They found that there's a really strong overrepresentation of Latinos. And so about over 90% of the people who are detained under the Secure Communities Program are Latino, even though they make up about 70% of the undocumented population in the country. So there is a big problem with an incentive for racial profiling when you have programs like this that are fingerprinting programs that operate at the point of arrest prior to the person receiving due process.
So we have a little bit of time left. Again, if you want to get in on the show, the number is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com or post a comment on kalw.org or on our Facebook page. In keeping with some of these points that have been made, I mean, what can people locally do, either to influence the legislation or if they're interested in these issues? Obviously, the Asian Law Caucus is a critically important local organization. What are some of the things that local folks can do to be involved?
You are asking me a question exactly at the right time, because it just was announced that tomorrow there's going to be a big rally in front of City Hall in San Francisco at 11 a.m., and the rally is going to be to push for comprehensive immigration reform. And so there are a number of key action dates that are happening. There's going to be a National Day of Action on April 10th, where people throughout the country are going to be pushing for comprehensive immigration reform, because we can't expect people in D.C., our policymakers, just to do the right thing. There needs to be community pressure throughout the entire country, especially coming from the Bay Area, asking not just for comprehensive immigration reform, but humane and fair reform.
Emily Lamb?
And I think Angela's right that this is such a great time for folks to come out and be active on this issue. And the great thing is that our interests are not mutually exclusive. So whether you're for a path to citizenship or H-1B visas or, ag worker rights, there's something here for everybody to get involved in and demand that this happens. So even though we talked about at the beginning of the program that the political calculus for this is different and that this is shaping up to be an incredible opportunity for us to pass immigration reform, the from now until it actually gets passed is a path littered with minefields that can be blown up by many different things. And so it's important for folks to let, not only the Bay Area and the California congressional delegation know what we want, but to help, if you have relatives in places where there's going to be swing states, it's going to be important. If you have friends that you can educate about the importance of this issue, whether it be through going to a day of action or making phone calls, sending support letters, it's important for all of us to come out. So one of the great things that we're getting involved in is a social network platform called MarchForInnovation.com that Mayor Bloomberg put together to basically create a grassroots movement for the tech community and those interested in innovation to advocate for H-1Bs and for entrepreneur visas and STEM visas. So one of the main tools they're going to use is something called the Thunderclap, which aggregates Facebook and Twitter's so that you can do one big massive tweet or one big massive Facebook post to a congressional person. So, and this can be done, you know, wherever you live, you can certainly sign up for these things. And again, a grassroots movement, you know, social media platform called marchforinnovation.com.
Well, I want to endorse what both Angela and Emily have said, because the time is ripe to put pressure on Congress. And we're spoiled a little bit here in the Bay Area, because the congressional delegation here is pretty much uniformly in favor of comprehensive immigration reform. So we have to broaden ourselves a little bit outside the Bay Area and reach our Republican members of Congress, because they really are the ones that are going to hold the key. Senator Boxer has been very good but silent. Senator Feinstein has been relatively good but silent on certain issues, and I think we have to continue pushing them. But I think the House is the focus at this time.
Now, if this passes, is this going to change state-local relations or federal-state relations? Will this change sort of how we approach immigration generally, the power sharing between the levels of government?
If this passes, everybody's going to be busy helping with legalization applications. But unfortunately, the legislation actually does not address the relationship between the federalism issue, the relationship between the state and the federal governments. I think that's an oversight. I think the White House has not wanted to talk to anyone about secure communities. The White House, as you noted earlier, they're into E-Verify. The Senate is into increasing drones along the border for monitoring and further militarization of the border. And when it comes to enforcement, unfortunately, unless there's an SB 1070 type of thing, the feds are fine with the way things are.
And I should say, at the Asian Law Caucus, in terms of how to get involved for Asian American members of the community and those who want to support the Asian American community, we just partnered with 18 Million Rising, which is an online movement-based group that's going to help get people involved in pushing for comprehensive immigration reform, because we do have 1.3 million estimated undocumented Asian immigrants in our country. So we need to make sure that the Asian voice is also loud and quite proud. And so I do encourage your listeners to go to the 18 Million Rising webpage and the Asian Law Caucus webpage to get engaged.
And something that shouldn't be lost on the listeners is that this is such a unique opportunity in which things are lining up. We may not get the chance for this kind of reform for quite a while. And so, you know, the urgency to get it done right now is very important, whether it be because, you know, you're separated from your family or you're undocumented and or you're a startup company and you can't recruit the people you need to start your business, we can't afford to wait anymore, and we need to press upon the legislature.
So in the remaining minutes, you know, I always hate this question, so I'm going to ask it of each of you. How do you handicap this? Is this going to, you know, is it going to go the way of sequester and the grand bargain's going to fall apart, or are we going to get comprehensive immigration reform in this Congress?
I think it's going to depend on us as members of the community, how loud we ask for this and how much we demand from our representatives in Congress. I think it's really up to us.
I agree. The people who have been against whatever pieces of immigration reform have been put out in the past have been louder. And I believe that if we all band together in coalition, we can get this done. And, you know, but that's going to take activism. And like I said, there's so many things that could blow this up, but I think that if we band together, we can see it happen.
Yeah, I think something's going to happen. There's a lot of incentive to get something positive happen, and it will only fail if the right adds some poison pills in the legislation that the rest of us cannot support.
Thank you. Thanks to each of you. That's City Visions for this evening. Our guests tonight were Bill Hing, professor at the University of San Francisco School of Law, and chair of the San Francisco Immigrant Rights Commission, Angela Chan, senior staff attorney at the Asian Law Caucus and member of the San Francisco Police Commission, and Emily Lam, senior director of healthcare and federal issues for the Silicon Valley Leadership Group. Thanks each of you for taking the time to be with us tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
For a link to this and other City Vision shows, let us know what you thought about tonight's program and subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page on kalw.org. Our engineer this evening was Kevin Vance. Tonight's show was produced by Susie Britton. Join regular host Joseph Pache next Monday as we discuss online college education. This is guest host Corey Cook. Thank you for listening. Good night and have a great week.